We're going to have to increase caseworker salaries up to some realistic professional level like we pay teachers. We're going to have to pay 100% of foster care, and it's going to be a big bill. And people are going to have to say, what's their priority?
I'm going to start this episode by reading for you an excerpt from an article that recently ran, I think it was the Associated Press, about the child welfare system in Texas, which is the subject of today's episode. At 5, the girl identified as S.A. entered the Texas foster care system. Within months, she reported being raped by an older child. She was moved more than 45 times, including to psychiatric hospitals, and missed several chances for adoption because of paperwork delays. At 18, after aging out of the system, she walked into traffic and was hit by a car. At last report, she was living in a homeless shelter. Her story, detailed in court records, was among scores of chronic foster care failures that led a federal judge to declare the Texas system unconstitutionally flawed and order an independent overhaul. Unquote. Merriam-Webster defines foster as affording, receiving, or sharing nurture or parental care, though not related by blood or legal ties. For the state of Texas to take the word foster seriously, it would mean our tacitly admitting that children, all children, deserve all of the care, all of the nurturance, all of the resources that we can afford to give them. This entails not just the right values, not just the right intentions, but the right system. As our guest on this episode will make clear, child welfare is a system. In our case, one that is shot through with inadequate staffing, inadequate funding, low morale, and untenably large caseloads. Fixing this system will take more, so much more, than an occasional public whipping and grandstanding by politicians. To give us a sense of just how much more, F. Scott McCown is a clinical professor and director of the Children's Rights Clinic at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. He's a member of the Hawk Foundation's National Advisory Council, and he is here with us to offer some perspective on the unfolding crisis in the Texas child welfare system. Judge McCown, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Ike. Thank you for inviting me.
Just recently, Judge Janice Graham Jack, in her ruling on the Texas foster care system, was quoted as saying that the system is, and I quote, broken and has been that way for decades, and that children almost uniformly leave state custody more damaged than when they entered. Is that overstatement?
Well, for the typical reader, that's going to be misleading, but it's a very important statement, and let me kind of explain what I mean by that. When, of all the children that enter into the care of Child Protective Services, roughly 45% move fairly quickly to go with kin, so they exit the system and they're with family. Roughly 31% move fairly quickly to get returned home. So that's over three-quarters of all the children who are either with their parents or with extended family. Then about 16% of the children are adopted. So that's 92% of all of the kids that exit the system fairly, in a fairly standard way, and move on to better situations than they came from. There is a group that grow up in care, that enter the system and never exit until they, as we say, age out. And that group is about 7% of all kids. And that's really the group that Judge Jack is focusing on, that 7%. And I might point out, the department's worked hard to get that down. It used to be about 10% of the kids aged out, and they've got it down to about 7%. Now, those are kids whose lives have been very hard. Their parents have not been able to care for them. They either don't have extended family or extended family hasn't been able to care for them. For whatever reason, they haven't been adopted. They may be part of a large sibling group, or they may have behavioral issues or mental health issues, and they are being raised in the care of the state. Now, that's the group that Judge Jack focuses on, and I think has correctly identified that the state's not doing what it needs to do for those kids.
Okay, and so, and one particular aspect of the problem, you know, that people tend to focus on is just the enormous caseloads that CPS workers carry. And so in terms of that, what are the current best practices in this area, or rules of thumb that if you're a good, you know, Child Protective Services agency that you would try to follow? And how far does Texas deviate from the norm?
So the term caseworker is kind of a bureaucratic term, and I want to think for a minute with our listeners about what that means. When a child is removed from their parents, who are the ones that are their caretakers and their advocates, a state public employee becomes their caseworker. That's the person who is their advocate, who's working to get them into a permanent home. And there's a lot of work involved in that. There's a legal case that has to be processed. There's social work to try to work with the parents or to try to identify and work with kin to try to find that child a permanent home. And if you've got too many children on your caseload, then you can't do the work that you need to do for each one. So the judge took 2012 as the base year. That's the year they had evidence for. And the state's own target number was a caseload of 29. And yet the state had an average caseload of 34. So we weren't even meeting our own target number. But our target number is roughly double what national standards say it ought to be. The Child Welfare League of America and the Council on Accreditation, which accredits systems, says that a caseload ought to have about 15 kids. So our caseworkers are carrying extraordinary caseloads, double what they ought to be, and they can't get the work done that they need to do so that the kids are safe and in good placements and ultimately in permanent placements back with a parent or with a kin or adopted. And because the workload is so heavy, caseworker turnover is incredibly high, about 27% annually. So caseworkers are constantly leaving. And when they leave, that means more work for those left behind. That means kids' needs aren't met. And so that's just a real problem.
Okay. And I'm sure, you know, that CPS workers, you know, feel the public pressure to do their jobs better, whatever that might mean. Now, in your opinion, what kinds of pressure are apt to be effective, and what kinds not? Just given the kind of attention that this is now getting, maybe some of it helpful, some of it not.
Well, when you talk about public pressure, it reminds me of that old saying, the lashing will continue until morale improves. You cannot take a punitive approach to this problem and expect to see improvements. When you've got people walking out the door at the rate of 27% a year, because you're working them too hard and you're not appreciating them and you're not supporting them, then trying to work them harder and appreciate them less and support them less is not the answer. What we need to do is get away from a punitive approach, and we need to have an immediate, significant salary increase. So these are college graduates who are in charge of the lives of children, and we are paying on average $34,000 a year, $34,000 a year for a job that's far in excess of 40 hours a week, that has a tremendous amount of responsibility and is very stressful dealing with child abuse and child neglect. Now, contrast that with teachers. We pay teachers roughly $50,000 a year on a 9-month contract. So it's a 9-month contract as compared to a 12-month contract. It's $50,000 a year as compared to $34,000 a year. That's out of whack. Our caseworkers should make what teachers make. We should raise salaries up to $50,000. If we did that, it would show them that this is our priority, that we care about them, that we support them, that this is important work, and it would put a floor on that turnover and give us a chance to build our workforce so that we could have reasonable turnover. Teacher turnover is high too, but it's about half what turnover is for CPS. And if we could get turnover reasonable, we could get caseloads reasonable and stop that death spiral we're in.
Okay, and in your own opinion, what exactly does it take to recruit and support more foster parents? Because that's been identified as another problem area.
One of the things Judge Jacks identified was the turnover and the caseloads, but another thing she identified, as you just said, was a lack of foster placements. We have kids right now sleeping in state office buildings. We have kids stuck in psychiatric hospitals who should be discharged, but there's no place for them to go. And we just don't have enough homes. So your question, what do we do about it? Well, we have to stop thinking about foster parents as do-good volunteers and start thinking about foster parents as what they really are, which is treatment professionals. Today's foster parents who take a child into their home are part of a treatment team designed to treat pretty serious abuse and neglect. And that takes a special set of training, a special set of skills, and we need to think of them as what they are. The other thing that we need to do is recognize the sacrifice foster parents make. Years ago, when Daddy was working and Mama was at home with the kids and she volunteered to take in a few extra kids, that was an economic model a family could make work. But now, in our modern economy, Mom's at work and Dad's at work and traffic is horrendous and trying to get kids to doctor's appointments and school and therapy is quite a challenge. And we need to recognize that foster homes need adequate support. They need an adequate daily rate for taking care of the kids and being part of their treatment. They need child care so that the kids can go somewhere while they are at work. And they need to be supported by the agency that they work for. Now here's what, this is not rocket science. The state of Texas only pays 80% of the cost of foster care. So the other 20% is picked up by philanthropic gifts to child placing agencies, or just goes undone. The contract calls for it, but it doesn't happen because there's no money to do it. And so if we want enough foster care and if we want quality foster care, we've got to pay 100% of the cost. We can't turn to charity with these kids and expect that we're going to be able to take care of them.
All right. And as you've seen, there's a lot of grandstanding from politicians on anything having to do with kids. And in your opinion, which state leaders, because I'm sure that you've worked with more than a few, have actually made serious, in your opinion, attempts to address the issue?
Well, let me answer that with a bit of pessimism and then a bit of optimism. So I've been shocked, really, that Judge Jacks's decision has gotten so little attention and discussion. It came out in December, right before Christmas, and it's 7 months later, and little concrete action has happened to address the problems that she's identified. There are some things that have happened. The governor has sent in a new leadership team, Hank Whitman is the new commissioner. He's a former Texas Ranger. Christine Blackstone is the new assistant commissioner for Child Protective Services, somebody that's worked in this field for a long time. So the governor sent in a new leadership team, and the speaker has said that this is an issue that will be addressed in the legislative session. I know that the House is going to have some hearings. The Senate, I'm sure, will have some hearings, and I hope steps will be taken. But we are moving very slowly on what is, in fact, an emergency problem.
Okay, and whenever there is a high-profile tragedy involving the death of a child, and in some respects, you know, it would almost seem that it's one other way that those are unfortunate is that, you know, people just tend to zero in on those particular kinds of tragedies, even though the problem, you know, goes much deeper and is a lot more systemic. It only seems too obvious what should have been done after the fact in those cases. But why does it not work out that way in practice?
Well, I think you make a very important point, Ike, when you say it's only too obvious after the fact. I like to say everything is foreseeable in hindsight, right? If you're using hindsight,
sure,
everything's foreseeable. And that's what we do. We take a single case, we look at it with hindsight, and we see very clearly how things went wrong. When a caseworker, though, is working the case, they don't have one case. They've got 100 cases. So it's a little bit like a forward pass. If you throw a forward pass downfield to a receiver, it's real clear to see how the receiver fumbled the ball, didn't complete the pass. You can see that real clearly in a single case. But it's not one ball that's coming at a receiver. It's, as I said, double the number of balls that ought to be coming, and they've got to catch them all, and they're going to drop some, and then it's going to be real clear why they did it if you just look at it with a microscope. But if you pull back and take a panoramic view, you're going to understand it's a systemic failure, not an individual failure.
Okay, and so when you look at the state, you know, there are people who manage to work miracles with even with the meager resources that they have. So, I mean, who is doing better than expected? And are there any models around that, you know, that we can emulate?
This is very difficult work. Under the best of circumstances, it's very difficult. And states across the country have difficulty. And I don't know that you can point to a single model state. You can point to states where this is going well or that's going well in a particular state, but I don't know if I would say there's a model state. They all have their challenges. And likewise, inside our own state, when you look at our communities, there are communities that do this well or communities that do that well. I don't think there's a single community I would point to as a model. They all have their challenges. One very promising project is foster care redesign, which is an effort to really rethink how we do this all together. And it's up in Fort Worth, in the Fort Worth area, and some counties west of Fort Worth. And it's an effort to use managed care, performance-based contracting to try to get better outcomes for kids. And it's having some very promising initial results. So there are some good things happening, but there's not a system you can feel good about from top to bottom.
Okay, and so I sent you an article yesterday. I think it ran in Reporting Texas about residential treatment centers, which it characterizes as a bright spot, you know, whatever that might mean. So, I mean, if that's something you know anything about, what do the best of these places do differently?
Well, first, let's tell our listeners what residential treatment is. So a residential treatment center is when you take a child out of a home setting and you put them into what is called congregate care. And it would look like what most people think a juvenile detention center looks like, frankly. it's not a psychiatric hospital, but it's working with lots of kids that may have mental health problems or that may have pretty serious behavioral problems. And it's trying to get their behavior or their mental health stabilized so that they can go back in and function successfully in a smaller, more intimate family setting. And, you know, there are better residential treatment centers than others, and certainly we must have residential treatment centers. We need that kind of capacity. But the best thing we can do is not use residential treatment centers at all. It's keeping kids in homes without resorting to residential treatment. And people are always saying, how do we reduce our residential treatment population? It's really, the answer is not really so much having better residential treatment as it is having stronger foster homes. If we have strong, therapeutic, treatment-oriented foster homes, we can avoid disruptions of putting kids into residential treatment centers. If a child does need a residential treatment center, that should be short-term. That should be 30 or 60 days. And when you're looking at stays of 3 months or 6 months or 9 months or 12 months, then that is a child who has extraordinary serious problems or a residential treatment center that's not being effective. Because ideally that care should be 30, 60, 90 days, not 90, 120 days or 365 days. And so that's my take on residential treatment centers.
And I guess that kind of segues well into my next question, which is about foster group homes.
So those are exactly the kinds of homes that we shouldn't have. We should have small therapeutic foster homes that are caring for a limited number of children with a sophisticated treatment team. Foster group homes are what we've been pushed to because we don't have enough homes. So let's tell our listeners what a foster group home is. It's a home that may have somewhere between 7 and 12 children or youth, perhaps in addition to the biological children that the foster parents are raising. So there might be a biological child or two, plus maybe as many as 12 other children and youth. And at that point, it really stretches imagination to call that a home. That's more like an orphanage than it is a home. But we're pushed to that because we don't have enough homes. Judge Jack, in her opinion, found that these homes were very dangerous. You're mixing children and youth. You're mixing boys and girls. You're mixing a lot of different kinds of problems. And you just have, at best, a mom and a dad in the home, two adults, perhaps. And they didn't have, and many of these homes didn't have 24-hour awake staff. So if the home had additional staff, it wasn't staffed so that an adult was awake monitoring the kids for 24 hours. So mom and dad go to bed, staff goes home, lights go out, and you've got 12 kids, maybe 14 kids in the home. What's happening? You're mixing boys and girls, you're mixing ages, you're mixing different kinds of problems. And so the judge, that was the one order she entered, was that there be an immediate ban on these foster group homes that did not have 24-hour awake staff. But that's just the first step. We have to develop a very strong system so that we're minimizing the number of these foster group homes we use at all, and the ones that we do use are adequately staffed.
The federal judge, Judge Janice Jack, has appointed two special masters to present some kind of reform plan. I think they have until
September
to report. What do you think of that approach? And have you had a chance to, you know, to give input or testimony?
So to understand a bit of how this works, the judge is doing this in two stages. So the opinion she released in December was the first stage. It was liability. She had a trial. She heard the evidence. She found that the state was violating the federal constitutional rights of this group of children because it was subjecting them to an unreasonable risk of harm. Then she said, okay, I found the states violating their constitutional rights, but I'm not going to issue an order yet on what the state has to do to fix it. I'm going to appoint these two experts who are going to come in and look at the evidence in this case and talk to the department and develop a plan. And then I'll look at the plan, have a hearing on the plan, and so much of the plan as I think is appropriate under the law, I'll order the state to implement it, and then we'll have finished the case. We'll actually have finished the second stage of the case, the remedy, and then the state will appeal. So the state's already announced that it's not going to agree to any settlement, that it doesn't think it's violating whatever its problems, it doesn't think it's violating the constitutionally required minimums. And so once you get Judge Jack's remedy, the state's going to appeal to the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, the federal appellate court. And if the Fifth Circuit grants a stay or a hold, then nothing will go forward until the Fifth Circuit decides whether Judge Jack is right. If the Fifth Circuit doesn't grant a stay, or after granting a stay decides she is right and affirms her, then we go into the third stage of the case, which will be implementation. The state will have to implement everything that the judge has ordered. So this is going to be a very long process, and I very much hope that the judge gives a final order before the legislative session, so that the legislative session has a roadmap of what needs to be fixed and can maybe come up with some solutions and come up with some dollars, and we don't have to wait to get going on addressing these problems. But one possibility is that nothing happens until the Fifth Circuit decides the appeal.
Okay, and so I have one more question, not among the ones that I sent you, but let's maybe talk about it just a little bit. So as you look at the public conversation around this, and again, you know, my own sense is that people have a natural tendency to key in on those things that are easy to sensationalize. But what would you most like to get across to the public about this issue that you think that even all the standard reporting that's being done, you know, doesn't do enough to really bring out, if there was any one thing?
If there's any one thing that I would want the public to understand, is that it's going to take hundreds of millions of dollars to address this problem. We have over 7 million children in Texas. Almost 2 million of those children live in poverty. We get 300,000 alleged victims of child abuse or neglect a year. And though the legislature has treated CPS better than some health and human services, and though they've put money in it constantly, it has never been scaled to the size of our problem. And it's going to take hundreds of millions of dollars. We're going to have to increase caseworker salaries up to some realistic professional level like we pay teachers. We're going to have to pay 100% of foster care. And it's going to be a big bill. And people are going to have to say, what's their priority? Do they prefer for these children to be subjected to the kind of horrible abuse that Judge Jack found they are subjected to and have the kind of very limited lives and opportunities that Judge Jack has outlined? Or are they going to insist that their legislature pay the bill? And are they willing to pay the taxes to make good on it?
Okay. F. Scott McCown, National Advisory Council member and clinical professor at UT School of Law, thank you so much for joining us today and for dropping some wisdom on this issue that finally is getting, you know, something close to the attention that it deserves. And so we really appreciate you helping to frame things for us.
Thank you for having me, Ike. I was happy to be with you.